Thank you, Claudie. So that's what we're going to go and look at now. So just give you a little bit of a hint, if you've not been here throughout the series, this is where we're at. So King Xerxes, this king of Persia, this vast empire, has got rid of his queen, and there's a new queen in town, Queen Esther. And she's a Jew, but she's kept her nationality a secret. And Mordecai, who we saw in the passage there, is the queen's cousin. He looked after Esther and brought her up after her parents had died. But he refused to bow down to the Prime Minister, Haman. And Haman didn't take very kindly to that. And it wasn't enough just to get rid of Mordecai and kill Mordecai. He wanted to get rid of all the Jewish people. So he orders genocide. And what we saw last week was Mordecai persuaded Esther to stand up and speak out for her people, the Jews, and approach the king, even though it could risk her life, to approach the king and asked for help for her own people, the Jews. So that's kind of where we're at as a very, very brief summary, if you haven't been here. But there's, there's a PowerPoint there. C.S. Lewis, the author of the well-known Narnia series, he wrote this. He said, "Coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous." And there's definitely lots of coincidences in the book of Esther. Esther's this classic story, isn't it, of this anonymous work of God. We've been seeing throughout the series, and now here in chapter 5, we see this whole series of events, one thing after the other, where we see that God's name is not mentioned, but we see these coincidences over and over where God is at work and he is in charge of everything. And so when we get to the end of chapter 4, as I mentioned, Esther has said that she will stand up for her people, the Jews, and go to the king. It says there, the end of chapter 4, verse 16, I will go to the king, even though it's against the law, and if I perish, I perish. It was against the law for someone to approach the king, to go into the king's presence when they haven't been summoned. But last week we heard that Esther now has come to this realization that she has a higher responsibility to a higher throne where there's a king greater than King Xerxes, and it is that king who she must now listen to and bow the ultimate knee to this king, the Lord of Lords, to God. And so when she says here, if I perish, I perish, we might hear those words. They're not empty words. They're not simply said as a statement of guts and determination. But actually, this is a real acknowledgement of a real huge risk that she's putting herself in approaching this king. Now, you know, might know here the story of Esther extremely well. Perhaps as you've got through the series, as we've got into this series, you might be thinking, how does the book end? I'll read it for myself. And you might be very familiar how the story ends here. But that does mean that the tension that is built up in the storyline here, particularly when we get to chapter 5, that might be lost on you because you're very familiar with the story. So can I ask you, as much as you can in your own head, try and stay as much as you can within the chapter. Feel the tension of the chapter, and we lose the benefit of the drama and the storyline if we're constantly trying to push beyond it. And so we need to feel the tension here that Esther's in, how vulnerable she is. She says, chapter 4, verse 11, doesn't she, that everyone knows that approaching the king inside the court without being called on, there is one law: to be put to death. That's what the situation she's in. The king's not going to have his security, he's not going to have his privacy questions, and that was shown with six henchmen with their axes ready to move the head of someone if they approached the throne. There's only one exception, which is what we see, chapter 4, verse 11. Esther points out that if the king decides that someone is allowed to enter, that is shown by this king holding this golden scepter, this symbol of power, towards that person, and only then can this person approach the king. And so Esther's determined. We saw that last week. She's now determined, and she's going to face this possibility of death. And it pretty much comes down to Esther has two options, and neither of those options are particularly great. Either she could stay in the palace, and she might die anyway under the genocide, or she can approach the king and maybe die there. That's kind of her options. And so we're going to look at some points as we go through this story. And I think the first thing that we see with Esther now determined to go to the king, what I think we see is actually the wisdom of Esther. We see your wisdom. As we went through the passage, as Claudie read it there, and perhaps as you scan the text now and look at Esther's wisdom, she approaches the king. She's brave, she's cautious, she's humble. So I think wise is the right words. She's very delicate in how she handles this situation, isn't she? She's precise. She's carefully planned it. You know, that statement, only fools rush in. That's right on this occasion. Esther's not going to appear in the presence of this king like a bull in a china shop. And Esther's determined. She's made this decision to go to the king, to speak to the king, but she's wise in how she did it, isn't she? I think that's perhaps a lesson that some of us could potentially learn. Some of us, maybe once we've decided on a particular topic, decided upon something, we say, right, I've made up my mind what to do. This needs to be done. I'm the person to do it. It doesn't really matter how I affect or whom I offend in doing this. And actually, when we act like that, actually, we perhaps act in a way that's an entirely unhelpful or unedifying. And so we need to perhaps look at Esther's example here. She's determined to obey God. She's determined to do that now. She's resolved to do something, even though she might die. But at the same time, she approaches this situation wisely. And I think this wisdom that we see here is seen in a number of different ways. I think, firstly, we see that Esther's wise in what she wears. I know that sounds random, but we read, don't we? On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes. The time of 3 days of fasting and praying, that's what we saw last week, that time is now over, and now it's time for action. And she puts on her royal robes. And here you might be thinking, is this what we're seeing in chapter 2 as well? Chapter 2, Esther's there dressed and getting ready to see the king with a load of other girls who potentially might be queen. In chapter 2, if you remember the king's servant, you can flip back there if you want, Hegai, he's basically a fashion consultant. His job was to make sure all these young girls were properly prepared in their dress and everything in order to meet the king. This man, this fashion consultant, would basically make sure someone like Esther was properly dressed with the expectations of, let's be honest, a sexually immoral king. So I thought, is that what's happening here in chapter 5? Esther's like asking Hegai here, would the king prefer it if I wear heels or not? Is that kind of what we're seeing? But Esther 5's not saying that. She puts on her royal robes. She's wearing the clothes that are now fitting for her position as queen. She has this beauty that God has given her. She has this responsibility, she has this personality that God has given her, but she's wise in what she wears here. We know from the previous chapter, if you remember, the king, the queen, this husband and wife, haven't seen each other in like a month. And now when the king saw her, we see verse 2, I don't know, maybe his jaw dropped open or whatever, at her beauty, her elegance. But now, looking at his wife now he's seeing someone who isn't just queen by title, but dressed as royalty. You know, we see next week, I'm sure many of us will be tuning in to see the coronation. I don't think Charles is going to be wearing some skinny jeans and a hoodie. He will be dressed like royalty, fitting for the occasion, won't he? And that's what Esther's doing here. It's wisely does here. Who knows what Esther actually looked like here? I don't know what she would have looked like. But she shows wisdom in how she dressed. But secondly, and kind of linked as well, she shows wisdom in her behaviour, verse 2. Esther acts exactly as she should have behaved. Verse 2, when the queen enters there, standing in the court, the king was pleased with her and held out the golden scepter. She's now free to approach the king, and she approached and touched the tip of the scepter. She acts wisely. Now, she doesn't say, look, I don't need to bother with all this protocol. I'm queen. I'm here. This is what I need to say. King, you need to listen to me. No, she's going into an environment where she knows she's extremely vulnerable. And so when the king reached out this golden scepter, she accepted it in the way she was meant to. She's wise in her behaviour. The Bible teacher, Alistair Begg, he says at this point that there's something of Esther's clothes and something of her behaviour that are linked. Her clothes and her behaviour show her character. He says, often clothing shows something of the disposition of our hearts. It said something about our approach to one another and to God. Clothes actually matter. They actually convey something. And Esther's demeanor is conveyed in her clothing and in her behavior. But finally, in this point, I think we also see wisdom in Esther's dinner plans as well, Esther and her dinner plans, or this great banquet as well. This has won over the attention of the king, and so much so, he's so won over by her beauty and her elegance, he wants to do something for his wife now, doesn't he? He asks Esther three times what she would want. So verse 3, it says, what is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, I'll give it to you. It's got something of the Oliver Twist ring here, isn't it? I'll do anything. Anyway, it's a little bit of a ring to it. But the king says, look, even up to half my kingdom, and I'll give it to you. He's not actually going to give her half the kingdom, but it shows he's really saying, look, there's no limit on what I am prepared to give to you. You found favour in my eyes. Come on, Queen Esther, what would you want? And now the answer that Esther gives here is this our opportunity to stand up and step in for her Jewish people. It's a bit of an anticlimax in the end, isn't it? Because after all, we've had this great setup of chapter 4. Who knows that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this? That's Mordecai to Esther. Look, it's time for you to step up and step in for God's people, Esther. And now she gets there. And she gets this reply of, what do you want, Queen Esther? Anything you ask. And she goes, it's time for dinner. Would you like to go for dinner tonight? And bring Haman, bring the Prime Minister with you. I mean, it doesn't seem much, does it? You've got lights, you've got camera, and then kind of no action. It's just dinner plans. But the key thing is here, with her wisdom, she knows her husband. We've seen so far in the book that King Xerxes definitely liked his food. He's a bit of a foodie. He liked his parties. And Esther knows that a way to a man's heart is through his stomach. She knows her husband. And Xerxes, happy with this, he sends for Haman. In verse 5, they came to the feast that Esther had prepared. And perhaps as they were finishing the feast, verse 6, King Xerxes asked for the second time, what's your wish and it will be granted to you? What's your request? Even to half my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled. So now it's got to the point. She's going to tell him what she wants, right? Well, no. Verse 7, how about we do this again tomorrow night? Let's have another meal. So again, we might think, what on earth is going on here? It's a great story, and in our days of Hollywood drama, we understand this idea of creating tension, creating suspense. But why is Esther doing this? Why one feast and then two feasts? Why at the end of the first feast, did she lose her nerve a bit and pull out from telling the king what she really wants? You know, maybe she's just there about to say what she wants. And then she goes, well, if you really want to know what I want, if you really want to know what my request is, let's have another feast tomorrow. But what I think Esther's doing here, because she says, I'll answer the king's question tomorrow, she says at verse 8. I think what she's doing here is she's creating intrigue and curiosity in the king. You know, the king might really be thinking, what is it that Esther really wants? What is so important to her that she's doing this? So I think that's exactly what she's doing. She's being wise. She doesn't lose nerve on her part. Some have suggested that she has. But actually, I think she's just hooking him in. She recognises, actually, this is not going to be a small thing for the king to do. We've got the law of the Medes and the Persians. He's the Persian king. This is a law that he can't change. She recognises he's putting the king in a position where he's directly going against the prime minister's law, the prime minister he promoted. What she's asking him to do is significant. And let's remember, she's identifying, she will be identifying herself with a people who have a death sentence. And she's asking him to reverse the irreversible law. She's essentially asking him to lose face in front of his entire kingdom. This is no small thing. And so here I think she's wise. She's wise in her behaviour, in her thinking. But what I think the author brilliantly does here from the transition from verse 8 to then verse 9, we see this wisdom of Esther. But then secondly, we see the folly of Haman. That's our second point. The focus switches, doesn't it, in the story from verse 9. Haman's the focus. And Haman, there's this egomaniac who hasn't really forgiven just one man for not bowing down to him. He embodies, to be honest, he embodies Proverbs 26:12. Do you see a person wise in their own eyes? There's more hope for a fool than for them. And again, our author brilliantly here shows us Haman's folly, his pride, against that contrast of Esther's wisdom and her humility. Haman's been to this banquet, hasn't he, with Esther and the king. He's really enjoyed it. Verse 9, he went out that day happy and in high spirits. But because Haman's pride was so great, his joy was short-lived. Verse 9, it says he went out that day and he saw Mordecai sitting at the king's gate and he observed that he neither rose nor showed any fear in his presence. Haman went out happy and in high spirits, but because of his pride, everything changed. When he saw Mordecai at the king's gate, we're thinking, here we go again. From all the enjoyment, all the prestige, all the significance and the accolades, that was nothing to prevent him coming completely embarrassed and upset by this little old man, Mordecai, because he never stood up when he came when he walked past. And so verse 9, he is filled with rage against Mordecai. Not just a little bit offended, not just a little bit of a nuisance, filled with rage. I mean, it's not really a rational response, is it? But that's what pride does. It's not a rational response. Thing is, I see with myself, when I'm a proud person, nothing will kind of satisfy me. It says, is it, in verse 13, but all this gives me no satisfaction as I see Mordecai acting like this. When I'm a proud person, no one can ever really meet my standards. When I'm a proud person, there's always one other thing, oh, and then another thing, and then another thing. And that's why Paul writes, isn't he? 1 Timothy 6, verse 6, but godliness with contentment is great gain. Haman should, in one way, just be saying, who cares if this one Jew doesn't bow down to me? I mean, after all, look at me. I'm in a position of power, the most important position of government. I'm photographed all the time with the king now. There's few people out there with access to the king like me. I'm going to all the big feasts and the banquets. Who really cares about what Mordecai's doing? Haman can't bring himself to do that, can he? He can't. So what does he do next? With his pride, he goes home, doesn't he? And it says, verses 10 and 11, calling together his friends and his Zeresh, his wife. It's not that he comes home from this party and everyone's there at the house already, ready to welcome him. Hey, Haman, great to see you. How are you doing? No, he actually has his friends sent for and his wife sent for. And he has them brought in. He surrounds himself with these people who prepared to listen to him talk about himself. Again, this is what pride does. Once he puts the people around him who, let's be honest, are unfortunate enough to be able to listen to him, what does he do? Verse 11, he boasted to them about his vast wealth, saying, have you seen my latest pictures on Facebook from my holiday to the Maldives? Have you seen my latest painting I bought by Picasso? Why don't you come down to the basement and I'll show you my wine collection? What's he doing? After being hurt by little old Mordecai, Haman's here is just trying to reassure himself. Say in front of others, hey, look, do you realize how great I am? Do you realize how significant I am? He boasts as well, doesn't he? He boasts about his family, we're told. Don't get me wrong, there's obviously a correct way to be thankful for your family, but he doesn't do that. He just wants to brag. Verse 11, boasted about his many sons. I mean, his poor wife there, Zeresh, do you really think she doesn't know how many babies she's had? She's sitting there thinking, yes, I do know all this. Why are you telling me this? Why are you telling me? I think it's safe to say, isn't it, that Haman actually lives with the idea, he mistakenly has the idea that he is the center of the universe. And as defined in the Bible, I think Haman is a fool. He's a fool, but sadly, he actually fits pretty perfectly in our contemporary Western culture today. Who is it we're seeing in the popular magazines? Who is it we're seeing on the front pages? When was the last time you saw the best school teacher in the UK on the front of the Vogue magazine? Or the brightest, best, talented surgeon who saved hundreds of lives on the front pages? No, what we see in our day and age is the Hamans of the world. But the thing is, it's not enough for me to say tonight, look at the pride of Haman. Because I know when I look at the word, I also see my own sinful heart and my pride. And surely you can do the same. You know, we read, don't we, about the story of the Pharisee and the tax collector. But how often, if we're truly honest with ourselves, how often in reality are we the Pharisee in the story? We'll never say it. We're a good evangelical church. We'll never say it out loud, but we do subconsciously think, God, thank you, I'm not like other people. Thank you that I'm not like that person. But actually what each of us need to do tonight is see the state of our own hearts and say along with the tax collector, Lord, have mercy on me, a sinner. Have mercy on me, a sinner. And when we do that, Luke 18:14, talking of the sinful tax collector, and I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and all those who humble themselves will be exalted. Haman sets up this pole, doesn't he? We're hoping that Mordecai would be impaled in it the next day. But as we'll spectacularly see, actually, for all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and Haman will be humbled. So we see Haman's folly. But thirdly and finally, we can't finish this without talking about the sovereignty of God. This is, again, the underlying theme of the whole book, the entire book, the sovereignty of God. And the coincidences we do see in this book, as we said at the beginning, maybe there are God's ways of remaining anonymous. If you look at the story so far, in chapter 1, we had Queen Vashti, the first queen. She did not go and see the king when she was summoned to, when she was called upon. And as a result, what happened? The king got rid of Vashti. Vashti didn't go and see the king. She didn't do that because God told her not to go. It was her choice not to go. That was her decision. Esther was made queen instead of Vashti because of her beauty that she didn't create herself but given to her by God. And Mordecai, realizing that he's now been separated from Esther, been separated from the queen, what does he do when she becomes queen? He walks around, doesn't he, by the king's gates, trying to perhaps hear news on how his cousin Esther is doing. That's his choice. His cousin's now queen. I'm sure he could have got a pretty nice property on the suburbs of Susa there and chose to live there comfortably, but he chose to live here. And as a result, he hears about a plot to assassinate the king, and the king's saved. And the coincidence here is here, they continue and continue, and as we read, we'll discover that behind the surface of all these human decisions and actions, it's the work of God, isn't it? And even though God's name's not mentioned, this is a brilliant technique from the author here, whoever wrote the book of Esther, because it's a brilliant technique because by not mentioning God's name, that gives us an invitation to read the story looking for God's activity. He's not mentioned by name, so we're made to look, okay, where is God working in this story? And there are signs of God's fingerprint everywhere. On the surface, there's loads of coincidences, but then it forces us to see how God is working behind all of that. There's a Bible resource available called the Bible Project, and they do book overviews of every book in the Bible. And they say this about the book of Esther from the Bible Project. God's seeming absence does not mean he has abandoned his people. He uses the faithfulness of even morally compromised people living in a messy world to accomplish his purposes and to fulfill his promises. This book asks us to trust God, even when we can't see him working, and to hold to the confident hope that no matter how bad things get, God is actively working to redeem his world. Many of us sitting here tonight, we might be struggling with this kind of doctrine, this Bible teaching of the sovereignty of God, and lots of people struggle with it. And maybe you're at the point where you're thinking, I believe in the sovereignty of God and that God's in control. The Bible clearly teaches that. But how do I hold the sovereignty of God in one hand and then the free decisions of Mordecai and Esther on the other hand? How does that work? But you do have both. You do have both. God is sovereign, and Mordecai and Esther and Xerxes and Vashti and you and me, we also make decisions. If you have a manual watch, not electronic watch, but if you have a manual watch, if you take the back off the watch, what you'll see is there's lots of machinery. You'll see there's cogs and wheels and things like that. And they're all moving parts, aren't they? And these cogs, they go against each other. They go in opposite directions, don't they? But they go round. They go against each other and they perfectly fit in. And together, they work together in order that they produce the end result for you to tell the time. But that's what God's sovereignty and human responsibility are achieving. They fit together to achieve the end result. Don't take my word, take God's word for it. Go and read your Bible, see how that fits in. But this makes sense, doesn't it? This makes sense not just of the storyline of Esther, not just the storyline of the book of the Bible, but this makes sense of the storyline of your life as well. Because I put it to you, the writer of Ecclesiastes, he saw this. He came up eventually with the right answer in Ecclesiastes, didn't he? He says, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is utterly meaningless. And he tries after that all different sorts of things to find meaning. He says, I tried to become really educated and all I found in the end was sadness and despair. So then he tried comedy and he found out that comedy wasn't even that funny. He then says he tried to become rich and found out that that didn't answer his questions either. Until he says at the end, until I finally recognize that God is God. God is God. Have you done that? Maybe you're here tonight and you're an agnostic. You're questioning things. Christianity Explored is a great place to start. But we're glad you're here questioning things. Maybe you're actually here tonight and you're an atheist. And you've decided there is no God. And maybe you're here tonight just to prove your point. But how do you have meaning? Are you trying to find meaning in all the things that seem to lack meaning? Again, C.S. Lewis, on thinking about atheism, in his book Mere Christianity, he says, atheism turns out to be too simple. If the whole universe has no meaning, we should have never found out that it has no meaning. The only reason why there is meaning is because there is a God. And if we believe that God is everywhere, if we believe that God is sovereign, then why would we not believe that God is in control of even all the strange coincidences of our own lives? All those things that seem so strange to us and how they fit in together, God's still in control. So maybe coincidences are God's way of making himself anonymous. But with Jesus, that is God's way of making himself known. So have you been looking to Jesus? Do you trust Jesus in all those strange and odd and difficult circumstances of life? Knowing that with Jesus, he is a God who's in control. But perhaps tonight, rather than like Haman, you need to come face the facts tonight and say, Lord, have mercy on me, a sinner, and I will trust you, come what may. That in all our pleasures, Jesus is better. In all our suffering, Christ is enough. That he ultimately is a God who saves. Amen.